is the Next Trip Podcast with aviation insiders Doug and Drew. Together, with more than 40 years of industry experience, they are creating a network for other av geeks and travel enthusiasts to obsess about all things aviation. All thoughts and opinions are their own.
Good day and welcome to Boarding Pass 167, operating on February 6, 2023. This is Doug, an airline pilot, and I'm here with my buddy Drew, an airline ops manager and private pilot trainee. We're here to discuss aviation topics from an industry insider's perspective. Apologies to the listeners who might have hoped to hear at least some of our Tenerife and Taipei trip details. Unfortunately, due to scheduling conflicts, we're recording a little early this week before we both jet set around the world. You're just going to have to wait another week. Drew, how was your short week since we last recorded?
Well, some of the listeners commented that it sounded like I had a cold on the last episode, which was only a few days ago, and I'm still trying to shake this cold, so I'm sorry about my voice. It was a pretty easy week because I had my coworker sit at the desk while I did some admin stuff and got caught up on my emails. Can I tell you, it just feels so good to delete that last email. It's just a weight off my shoulders right before a trip. It's just a great feeling deleting all that stuff. But anyway, I want to get back. So one of our unpaid...
Well, can I say something yes. about that real fast? I don't think that I've zeroed out my emails in probably 15 years. I do remember how great that felt, uh-huh. and I don't think that I've done that on work computers, on personal emails. I sent you that screenshot of my inbox. It would give people with OCD nightmares. I have over 10,000 unread emails.
Well, I've deleted all mine, and I have about 12,000 in the deleted box. So I did have thousands in there. And I probably shouldn't be saying this where everyone can hear this, but if your email to me was 6 months ago and you have not called me on it, it probably wasn't that important to you. So I just deleted thousands.
That's very true. There was an article, I think it was in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal recently, about how email has turned into this thing where people don't even look anymore because it's so overwhelming. And part of that is because of all the emails that you get. We flew on Allegiant. We flew on Allegiant a couple weeks ago, and I keep getting Allegiant emails, same. And I keep thinking that I'm unsubscribing or sending them to my trash bin where they're going to go automatically. Yeah. And I don't know if they changed the email address or how it works, but all these emails just keep slipping through the cracks, even though I think that I unsubscribe. And it becomes overwhelming to the point where there might be an important email hidden somewhere in one of my multiple accounts, but I'm not seeing it because there are all these junk emails that are coming in. Not to call Allegiant junk, but it kind of is in a way, all these marketing emails.
Yeah, I mean, as far as work emails, I will tell you right now, I hate emails. I'm in the office every day. Just come and talk to me. I don't know if your work is my work now, but at your previous job, whether you had a messenger system. So we have this thing called Microsoft Teams, and I just tell them, please don't send me an email. Just send me a text message on Teams, and then I can take care of it, because you send me an email, it's going to be buried under, like, I literally, Doug, get 100 emails per day. And a lot of that is just stats, you know, constantly, you know, coming in.
Yeah, corporate communications.
Yeah, so email, I think, is a dying thing. If it's urgent, there's so many better ways to communicate. Anyway, so the email box is cleared. I do want to come back to something I said. So I wanted to put a lid on this Tenerife being identified with the worst air disaster ever. 583 people died when a 747 was taking off in Tenerife. They thought they had clearance, but they didn't. It was KLM, and it struck a Pan Am 747 that was crossing the runway. I said that those two planes were there because they diverted because of weather elsewhere. No, they diverted because there was a bomb at another Gran Canaria, which is another island in the Canary Islands. So there's something called the Canary Islands Independence Movement back then. So they exploded a bomb. So all these planes diverted. And that's why they were there, not because of visibility. But doesn't that strike you as amazing? Like, I'm not even sure where these islands are on a map, but they were flying 747s there back in 1977.
Yeah, our European listeners probably know them well. It's in a way, it's like our Hawaii, where it's the tropical destination that's not that far away, or our version of like Cancun or Cabo, something like that, where it's just a couple hour flight from cold Northern Europe. And a lot of Europeans go vacation in the Canary Islands. And yeah, I think that part of the reason why you thought that it was weather related, and I think I did too, is because the runway incursion and the ensuing accident happened because the visibility was so low in Tenerife that day. It was very foggy, and that's why air traffic control was blindly taxiing these airplanes, was blindly giving these airplanes takeoff clearance because they couldn't see them because the fog was so bad. And there's that famous photo where you can see the wreckage in the background and people bloodied and burned walking away from it. And you see very clearly that the sun is out and you can see pretty far.
Yeah.
The weather cleared up very soon after this accident to the point where a lot of researchers and people say that if they had just waited 15 minutes or so, that they wouldn't have even happened because the weather would have cleared up.
Yeah. And, you know, this is timely because we were talking about that incident at Kennedy where there was a near miss between a Delta Airlines plane and an American Airlines plane. It's like you're seconds to disaster. So it's a wake up call. So once again, thank you to Aaron, who is our unpaid quality control employee.
Yeah.
Who said, no, it wasn't due to fog. It was due to this other situation. And by the way, shout out to Aaron. Aaron is flying our airline and you'll be happy. Mid-con wide bodies both ways from LA to Denver.
Good. Yeah. Nice.
Doug, it has been a hard week or a bad month for aircraft. Last week, what was I sending you? A picture of myself and a buddy Ryan at a restaurant and we were drinking to the KC-10 because you did your KC-10 the last flight for that tail.
A retirement flight, yeah.
Retirement flight. And last night, we were drinking to the 747 because the last one rolled out of the factory. So it's been a really hard week for these classic airplanes, the DC-10 and the 747. You flew another KC-10. It was the simulator. That's the last time you're going to fly the simulator, and you're the one who certified those simulators. Tell me about that.
It was definitely bittersweet. Yeah, I had to go in just to get my monthly currencies so that I'll be current for when I do my final flight next month. And unfortunately, both my kids were homesick that day, so I had to rush in, do a quick landing, a touch and go, and another takeoff, and then I had to rush out. So I didn't really get a lot of time to reminisce in the sim, unfortunately. But yeah, it definitely was bittersweet going in there for the last time because I was in charge of those, as you said, for 2 years. And I know that was what I was doing when we first started the podcast, and I talked about it quite extensively about my job and what I was doing with them. It definitely was bittersweet. It's not my last time ever in an airplane sim by any means, and I'm going to be spending the next several months in sims as I move on to a new airplane in the Air Force. So it's not really bittersweet from a sim perspective, but bittersweet from the fact that, yeah, I was in charge of those for so long. And I've been on the KC-10 for 12 years now, which is crazy to think about.
So do you know the person who's taking that over from you? Or was there like a handoff, or have you talked to the person who's will be doing the KC-46 sims?
Yeah, it's still within the same office, and people are just shifting responsibilities. So I know all the people who are doing it, and I've stayed in touch with them. In fact, I golf with them from time to time, so I get some of the drama about what's going on with the sims and everything.
For the listeners, the KC-46 is a version of the 767. I think it's the 200, isn't it? It's a version of the 767-200?
Kind of. It's a Frankenstein airplane. We can save that because we'll talk more about it as I'm going through training. Well, as the listeners know, Drew and I are very optimistic about the state of the aviation industry, especially regarding innovations and new technologies, as long as it doesn't include replacing pilots altogether.
Right.
And while we've been high on the boom, supersonic transport, sustainable aviation fuels, and lots of other new technologies, we're also very nostalgic. As you mentioned, and as we've talked about, I fly the DC-10, and our podcast logo has a 747 predominantly displayed. Speaking of the 747, and you teased this a little bit ago already, Drew, we talked late last year about how the last 747 ever rolled off the line in Everett. Drew, I think we have an update on that airplane.
Yeah, Doug, on Tuesday, Boeing delivered the final 747, a 747-8F, to Atlas Air. Boeing put on a big show that was broadcast live online. The hangar doors were slowly opened to reveal the aircraft. There were flags with liveries of every airline to ever operate the 747. Those were displayed in the background. The aircraft, Atlas's 56th 747, was adorned with a nose decal that pays homage to the 747 chief engineer, Joe Sutter, who many call the father of the 747. Joe died in 2016, somewhat fittingly, while his groundbreaking aircraft was still being produced, nearly five decades after it was introduced. I'm 52 years old. The 747, so the last one just rolled off, and I'm about the same age as the 747 because the first one flew in 1968. To think that over 50 years later, they're still rolling one off, that is amazing. What a run.
That's incredible.
Lufthansa CEO Carsten Spohr, he became my hero during COVID when he said, not only are we keeping the 747, it will be our flagship. And I'm like, I became a Carsten Spohr fanboy.
A super fan, a fanboy.
And also because we get to fly on that, because we get benefits on that airline, so we can still fly the 47. Carsten Spohr said, the 747 is a symbol for many, many things. And above all, I think it's a symbol for the world, which the 747 has made substantially smaller. CNN pointed out that the 747 predates the moon landings, something that is nearly impossible to fathom.
That's crazy. Think about if you've seen any movies or TV shows about the space race from the 60s, think about the technology that those astronauts and the engineers had back then, how far technology has come since then. And we just rolled a 747 off the line that predates the moon landings. That's incredible to think of. Now, granted, the flight deck on the 747-8 is substantially different than the original 747-100, and there have been technological advances, but the airplane body itself is basically the same. They've stretched it a little bit, but the wing and the body are very close to the same, which is really incredible. And that quote from Carsten Spohr is great. That is such a fantastic quote. And even though this is the final delivery for the 747, that doesn't mean that she's flying into the sunset anytime soon. According to Cirium, who tracks airplane movements and schedules, there are still 314 active freighters and approximately 50 passenger 747s still in service today. Carsten Spohr's quote was bittersweet and poignant, but I think that my favorite quote to come out of the delivery was that of Virgin's Richard Branson. He said, "Farewell to a wonderful beast."
What a perfect way to describe it, a wonderful beast. I took the liberty, Doug, of adding a little cut and paste here just to see how the 747-8i, which is 1960s technology, right? 1960s technology. How does it compare with something that is similar or as close as we can get? So we're going to look at an A350-1000 and just check it out. The range of an A350-1000 is 7,992 nautical miles. The 747-8i with 1960s technology, 7,992 nautical miles, the same, right? Not only that, 467 passengers versus 369, so 100 more. About 25% more. She flies a little bit faster, and I believe the 747-8i is the fastest commercial airliner. We'll verify that, but looking at these stats, it looks like that is the fastest.
The A350-1000 is comparable to the 777-300, which was designed, well, initially it was not designed as a 747 replacement because Boeing was hoping that the 74-8 would replace the 747-400. But as we've talked about, airlines, they prefer two engines because they're more efficient. The 777-300 sat pretty close to the same amount of people as the 747-400. And I think we've talked about how, doesn't the 777-300 carry more cargo than the 747?
I don't think so. Yeah, we got to look at that. The 747-8i is a little bit longer, but as far as the cargo hold, that's a good question. Because the 747 is kind of sloped in the back, so I don't know if they make use of all that length of the plane.
Yeah, well, we'll have to look into that. And maybe we've talked about that in the past. I don't remember. But yeah, it's such an incredible airplane. It's sad to see it now done. Production run is done.
Well, you know, we will remember it. So last night I was telling Ryan, who's very young, it's like, I have so many 747 stories. And he said, I am so jealous because he doesn't have any. You know, a lot of people don't have any memories or even have even flown it. Even Avgeeks, Tyler, our buddy who does non-rev lounge, has never flown a 747. So I got a quick 747 story, and if you have one, let's add it. But we should be telling these for the next few weeks, maybe, as this airplane goes into the sunset. Imagine it, 1995 or so, a 747-200 from New York to Frankfurt. So I'm on standby. I'm a non-rev, probably like 25 years old. And waiting for my seat, I'm so excited. I'm excited to fly a 747-200. But Doug, I get a business class seat on the upper deck. So the 200 Continental was flying had business class on the upper deck. So it was two and two. I was sat next to the son of a Continental pilot. So it was a party. I mean, we were just laughing and joking and drinking the whole flight. And, you know, the things that you remember, I remember landing in Frankfurt or on descent or before for breakfast, the flight attendant brought out hot blueberry muffins. And I just still remember how luxurious that was. And the landing, you didn't feel anything. It was like you were just floating. Because the 747, you know, they say you can't do a bad landing on a 47. A 747 in the upper deck, you think you're still flying. You hardly felt it when it touched down. So that's my little story. I'm sure I have a dozen of these stories from the 47, which I'll keep dusting off.
One of my greatest memories, and I was lucky enough to fly the 747 quite a bit because Northwest flew them a lot domestically. My uncle was, aunt and uncle were living in Seattle, and we were living in the Midwest, and we flew Northwest from Minneapolis to Seattle almost every summer. And it was either on a 747 or on a DC-10.
Yep.
We might do one airplane one direction, the other airplane the other direction. So I flew a lot of 747s. My favorite seat on that airplane, I know that you're going to dislike this because it's a bulkhead,
yeah.
1A
oh,
or
no,
1D, because you're at the curve. You're right. You're literally at the tip of the nose, and it curves in to the point where you're partially looking ahead of you. You're partially looking down the runway.
Right.
It's such a weird feeling to be angled in like that and looking out the window, but yet moving forward.
Yeah,
and I just remember the several times that I was lucky enough to sit in 1A, taking the runway and then going down the runway, and you can see the runway out in front of you,
right.
Which on today's airplanes, you just can't see that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you won't get that again. Let's move to another last aircraft, Doug. So this is Horizon Air, which is a regional subsidiary of Alaska, operated its final Bombardier Q400 flight this week. This marks an end to turboprop passenger operations at major U.S. airlines. That's a good point. I didn't know that. So that marks the end of it. Several smaller carriers like Silver Airways and Cape Air still operate propeller aircraft. Our buddy Nate has a huge love affair with the Q400, and our other buddy Eric was just on the retirement flight.
Yeah, Nate, I know Nate mentioned the day of the flight. He sent us a message and said, guys, it's the last Q400 flight. And I reached out to Eric. I sent him a message and asked if he had any comments or anything, and he didn't get back to me. So maybe we can get some comments from him and talk about it next week. But this is another one of those things. I know that the Q400 is nowhere near as memorable as the 747, but turboprop aircraft flying for major carriers in the U.S., that dates back to the 1930s, 1940s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, I think that was piston back then. Turboprops were a little bit later, but propeller planes in general, that was the beginning of aviation. The mail carriers turned into passenger airlines. They're all propellers. Even at the dawn of the jet age and throughout the jet age, there were still propeller airplanes. I flew on dozens of propeller airplanes growing up in the upper Midwest on Northwest Airlines, Fokker F-27s, Metros, Dash 8s, the 100s and the 200s. I did fly the Q400 a couple times, ATRs. All these airplanes, they were a mainstay at all these carriers for so long. And then in the late 90s, the jungle jet, the E-135 and 145 mm-hmm. came out, and then CRJ-200, and then all these different variations of regional jets. Regional jets have overtaken the propeller plane, yep. At least in the U.S. now.
Yeah, exactly. Now, this Q400, it's a version of the de Havilland Dash 8, and that came in several sizes. So it was Dash 8 100 with about 33 seats, I believe, then the 200, 300, 400. So the Q400 is the largest version with about 90 seats. I have never flown one. Have you flown one?
Yeah, I did on Frontier from Denver to El Paso and back for a work thing about 15 years ago. That was back when Frontier, I think we've talked about it in some of our Frontier segments, when they were branching out and they actually had regional carriers flying for them. It was, I think, Lynx Aviation or Lynx Air was a regional subsidiary or a regional carrier for Frontier.
Did they have first
flight? They had quite a few flying in and out of Denver. That one did not, no.
Okay, how was the cabin? It looks really nice.
It was very nice. I actually preferred it over the CRJ-200. The windows were a little bit higher. They were a little bit bigger. The Q stands for quiet. There is no such thing as a quiet turboprop, but the Q400 definitely was more quiet than some of the older variations of the Dash 8. But one of my favorite memories of the Dash 8, or what I loved about the Dash 8, and like I said, I flew them probably a dozen plus times on Northwest Airlink and then on Frontier, the gear come out of the engines. So if you're sitting anywhere where you can see the engine, I just remember as a kid, like watching the gear come down. I loved watching the touchdown because on very few airplanes, can you actually see the gear touch the runway and you see the puff of smoke. Yeah, it's really cool.
Let's get to work with some of the news topics this week, Doug. So here we go again. Airlines were forced to cancel more than 2,000 flights due to snow and ice in the southern part of the U.S., a large ice and snowstorm pushed through Texas and other parts of the South on Tuesday and into Wednesday, forcing airlines to cancel nearly 3,000 flights. An additional 4,000 flights were delayed through Wednesday. Some of the hardest hit airports included Dallas-Fort Worth, Dallas Love, Austin, Nashville also had hundreds of cancellations. The hardest hit airlines were those with large operations in North Texas, mainly American and Southwest. Each airline canceled between 15 and 20% of their schedules. Oh my goodness. While this is a large disruption to the airline schedules, it isn't expected to devolve into the issues Southwest experienced over the holidays. One of the reasons for that is the load factors are less, so when flights cancel, we actually have places we can put these customers. And the rest of the country was pretty calm. It's been a very calm winter for the East Coast and even the Midwest, I think.
Yeah, I read an article about how New York hasn't had snow since last season, since the 2021-2022 winter, and they actually broke a record for the longest amount of days between snowfall. And I think a lot of the East Coast is like that. And yeah, it, as you mentioned, this didn't devolve or it hasn't devolved into what Southwest experienced over the holidays. And as you mentioned, part of that is it's midweek. It was very lucky that this was a Tuesday, Wednesday event because those are some of the least travel days of the week. If you look at the days of the week, if this had been on a Friday or like a Friday through Sunday, that would have been a much bigger disaster because those are pretty high volume times, Tuesday and Wednesday or not. And part of the reason I think why this is in the media's attention right now too is going back to Southwest and what happened. A normal winter, this probably would, a storm like this happens every winter. It happens almost every month over the winter.
Yeah.
It wouldn't make the news quite in the way that it is right now because it's still such in sharp focus for passengers, for the media, for the Department of Transportation. Everyone is laser focused on airlines right now. But this is unavoidable. You can't blame this on Southwest, you can't blame this on American, you can't blame this on anyone if you had a canceled flight on any airline. Safety comes first.
Yep.
And when people, like Nate, our buddy lives in Dallas, and he was saying he can't even drive to work right now because the roads are so icy.
Right.
That's part of the reason for the cancellations, is you couldn't even have people who are getting to work. And we talk about how this doesn't just impact that area. I've seen a lot on the pilot forums about pilots at our airline who live in the Dallas area, and they had to call out sick from work or say they couldn't make it because they couldn't commute to their job. So it affects a lot of the industry. Again, luckily, it hasn't been happening a lot this winter. I haven't really seen much in the news today about it devolving into anything big. And hopefully by the weekend, things will be back to normal. And as you mentioned, loads are down, which means that people whose flights are canceled, it's easier to get them back into the system. And in fact, Scott Kirby from United in the investor call last week mentioned that that airline has about 25% excess of airplanes and crews right now. And the whole reason for that is, and it costs money. That's lost revenue that they're not able to get. But he said that they would rather do it that way and be able to throw crews and airplanes at problems if they arise than stretch the schedule too thin.
Yeah, you're right. I'm glad that airlines are building some slack into it, because how do you expect nothing to go wrong? You know, and working in a operations environment, sometimes the flights are so full, the fleet is stretched to the limit, and we need to have a spare. We need to have an extra crew, extra, even if it's just one of every fleet. So if people from network operations centers for all the airlines are listening, for all of us poor operations people that have to deal with a cancellation and nothing to go to, especially at hubs, if you could just have one of each, one 777 crew, one 737, et cetera, just at the ready, because something is going to go wrong. Either it's going to be a plane that didn't get there, goes on maintenance, happens every time. I'm not expecting for us to have five crews and five planes sitting around, but maybe just one. Just saying, I'm off my soapbox.
Yeah. And speaking of Southwest holiday meltdown, we said that changes would come for what happened. Well, U.S. lawmakers are proposing ways to protect passengers after future meltdowns. The proposal includes verbiage that would force airlines to offer refunds for delayed flights and paid transportation on rival carriers. Under the proposed rules, airlines would be required to pay passengers at least $1,350 if they're denied boarding due to an oversold situation. It would prohibit airlines from shrinking seat sizes more than what they are today. It would allow passengers to sue airlines for unfair practices. And it would require refunds if flights arrive more than an hour late. The legislation is called the, quote, passengers' bill of rights and the Forbidding Airlines from Imposing Ridiculous Fees or FAIR Act. What are your thoughts, Drew?
I mean, this has been in the news for years and years and years, but it never becomes law. It's to the point where, don't we already have a passenger bill of rights? We don't. They were talking about it when you had the long taxi delays back in the late 2009, I think it was. So what we did get as far as legislation was the taxi time restrictions.
The three-hour rule.
They were able to impose that on the airlines, which actually, Doug, I think it's a good thing because having people on planes for 5 hours is unacceptable. So I think that there needs to be some guideline or some rule that says you can't do that. So all the airlines have become better. You know, before those rules, working in airport ops, planes would leave. We would kind of keep an eye on them. But we wouldn't track, once they're out of the gate, we kind of lost visibility on them. Now, since 2009, when they established these rules, we have a person who's, if it's a bad day, we have a person who's assigned to be tarmac desk and to watch those taxi times. And it's good. It's we're not just trying to avoid a violation. We are providing better customer service because when you get up to 3 hours, is that a really good product to keep people on a plane for 3 hours not going anywhere? I don't know if this will go through because they keep talking about it, but there are other countries, Doug, where it has gone through. So we fly
Europe.
Yeah. Europe and even Nigeria. Europe has a passenger bill of rights. Israel has a passenger bill of rights and Nigeria has a passenger bill of rights. So I wanted to these are some of the things that's in their passenger bill of rights. So this is the Nigerian passenger bill of rights. So just a few things from it. When a passenger's flight is to be rerouted or delayed, he or she must be notified at least 2 hours in advance. Okay, that's reasonable. Where a passenger has a printout showing a confirmed reservation, they must get a seat on that. Compensation must be paid if the flight departs before the ticketed time and the person doesn't get on. The last one, I don't know how they would police this. The last one is, if a passenger is treated rudely by airline staff or agents, he or she can claim compensation from the airline. I mean, would they have to have a video or something? So that's Nigeria, Israel. So our flights, the airline's flights to Tel Aviv, all airlines are expected to follow this if you want to fly to Tel Aviv. It just delineates hotel accommodations, if it's over 8 hours delayed, transport between. This is stuff that the airlines do anyway. So maybe some airlines are not providing that for their customers. I can tell you our airline and all U.S. carriers, if your flight's canceled, we're going to get you a hotel room. So I don't know how this affects us too much. There are some rules if a flight is delayed over a certain time.
A hotel room, unless I think the verbiage in some of the customer agreements that we're all supposed to read, but we don't when we buy a ticket, says if it's an act of God, the airline does not have to provide you accommodation. So if it's weather, if it's mechanical, if it's operations related, then they do. So it's not, and that's where passengers really start to get upset with the customer service agents when they're told, no, we're not going to compensate you for a hotel or we're not going to give you a hotel, even though the flight canceled. Now, one thing in this FAIR Act that stands out to me is the refund if your flight arrives an hour late. I don't know that's if I crazy. Agree with that one. Because there are certain situations, you're on the East Coast. You talk about Newark all the time, delays into Newark because of air traffic control, because of weather, because of things that are outside the control of the airline.
Right.
I think that if it's outside of the airline's control, like if a flight arrives an hour late because a crew wasn't in place or someone called in sick, then I could see giving a refund.
Yeah.
But if it is something that is completely outside of the airline's control, I don't agree with the refund.
Yeah,
and air travel has, as Carsten Spohr said, brought the world together.
Uh-huh.
It used to take months to travel these distances that we're traveling today. And people have just become so, I hate to call passengers spoiled, but we've become so spoiled to arrive on time, that when you arrive an hour late, people just get really upset about that.
Right.
And I don't think that that's a fair outlook compared to where we were just 100 years ago in humanity and travel.
Well, I'm thinking this might just be an impulsive, like they have to show that they're reacting to what happened at Southwest. It was one meltdown at one airline, which they're doing a good job compensating people from what I understand. So I think it'll just pass by the wayside again, like it has for the last 10 to 15 years, passenger bill of rights. Not to say the airline shouldn't take care of people, but each airline, as you just said, we have our contracts of carriage. So a lot of this stuff is already delineated that we will do. So I don't know if this is going to go through, but we'll watch that space. All right, let's head back to Seattle and Boeing news for our final story. While the 747 is now flying off into the sunset, the 737 is getting an expanded lease on life. Boeing announced this week that it plans to add a new 737 MAX production line, its fourth, sometime in the second half of 2024. The new line will be in its Everett, Washington factory, which also produces the 787. That's interesting. I thought they were moving all of the 787 production to Charleston.
I think they are, but currently the 78 is still being partially, or there is a line that's open there right
still
now.
A line open. Yep. Okay. The company said it will expand production to keep up with global demand for its best-selling aircraft. Boeing has wanted to expand production for a while, but it's been cautious due to the nagging supply chain issues post-pandemic. Stan Deal, Boeing Commercial Airplane CEO, said, "This undertaking is significant. In addition to preparing the facility, we have begun the process of notifying and preparing our suppliers, customers, and unions and employees as we take the necessary steps to create a new line," unquote. So Boeing currently produces 31 MAXs a month, but they want to increase to a rate of 50 a month. This number is astonishing, Doug. There's a backlog of 3,600 MAXs. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's not as big as the backlog for the A321 family, though. I think that's upwards of 8,000 right now because the MAX has been underperforming compared to the A321 family, the Neo family. Drew, the thing I want to focus on this is the Boeing 737.
Uh-huh.
Boeing's airplanes technology. Were introduced chronologically. It was the 707 and then the 727, right. 737. What came after the 737?
The 747. What was
the 747. And it just delivered the last one.
Yeah.
And now we are talking about 3,600 737s that are still in the production backlog.
Yeah.
I get it. This is the fourth generation of the airplane. A 737-200 is nowhere close to the same airplane as a 737 MAX 9 by any means, aside from just the width of the body, that and maybe the shape of the tail and the shape of the nose, but everything on the inside, all the avionics, all the seats, all the engines, all that, it's a totally different airplane. But the fact that the 737 has outlived the 747 is incredible.
Yeah, and get used to it because Boeing has put out there that they don't expect to start a new plane or plans for a new plane until about 2035. So 737s will be with us for a long time.
Drew, moving on to our fun topic of the week. I know that you're not a big sports fan, but I am. And don't worry, our main topic this week is tangentially sports related, but it's mainly an intersection of sports and aviation. As many people know, the Super Bowl is coming up in just under a week. It's a logistical nightmare regarding travel, especially since fans of the two teams playing in the National Football League championship game don't know if their team will be in it until just 2 weeks prior. Drew, how are the airlines handling fan travel?
Extra sections, which we love. Several airlines are adding additional nonstop flights from Kansas City and Philadelphia, the two cities whose teams are playing in the Super Bowl, to Phoenix, the city where the game is being played. Kansas City normally has around 8 nonstop flights a day on American, Southwest, and Frontier. In the couple days before the game and the couple days after the game, United and Delta will also offer nonstop flights, bringing a total to anywhere from 16 to 19 daily nonstop flights, more than doubling the normal total. One thing to mention here is neither of those, that's nowhere close to a hub of either of those carriers. So these are completely one-offs, non-hub to non-hub. Delta also added a nonstop between Wichita, Kansas and Phoenix. Philadelphia to Phoenix is a route that connects two of American's hubs, where it usually operates 6 flights. Frontier normally operates 1. In the days before and after the game, United and Delta are also joining the nonstop mix, bringing the average total daily flights between the two cities to 13, also nearly doubling capacity. These options for fans are efficient, but as av geeks, I'm not sure we'd want the nonstop option, especially after seeing some of the fares. Oh my goodness. $924 is one of them. American 820 arriving at 1140. $920, and I'm assuming this is economy?
Yeah, that's economy. That's from Philly to Phoenix. Frontier is $374, and these were yesterday. I haven't looked today. I'm sure the prices are going up, but it gets as high as $2,000 nonstop on American from Philly to Phoenix. And then Kansas City, just looking at some of these fares, On United, it looks like $390. American, $625. And I thought that I had a Delta one in there. I can't seem to find it right now. But it's pretty incredible just to see the prices of some of these nonstops.
You know what? It's a market economy, right? And there must be a huge demand to be able to ask for $2,000 for a nonstop from Philadelphia to Phoenix. I'm going round trip to Tenerife, and I think it was $790 round trip to Europe. And this is $2,000. But, you know, if people have the money, they really want to get to the Super Bowl, you can get there for $2,000.
Well, and that's just it. I saw a lot online, people talking about how if you have the money to go to the Super Bowl, what's a $2,000 flight for you? Right. Because the hotels are going to be outrageously expensive. The food, like, the city that hosts the Super Bowl, it is a huge financial boon for that city. They get millions of dollars every year by hosting the Super Bowl, because thousands of fans and lots of people who aren't even going to the game. I think State Farm Stadium only seats like 65,000 people, but they're expecting over 100,000 to fly into the city just to experience the event, to experience everything around the Super Bowl. And if honestly, if the Packers get into the Super Bowl again here in the next couple seasons, there's no way I could afford a ticket to the game. But depending on where the game is, would I like to go and just be there for the fan experience? Yeah, absolutely, I would. So there are a lot of people who do that. Would I pay $2,000 for a nonstop? No, as I mentioned, I'm an Av geek. I would find the cheapest option.
Right.
If it's three stops or four stops, then cool. That's more club time, more airport time,
more
airplanes. I don't want the nonstop anyways, usually.
Yeah, exactly.
Aside from the fact that these are ridiculously expensive. But it will be kind of cool to see, as you mentioned, United and Delta flying non-hub to non-hub for a week or so.
Right.
It's pretty cool what they're doing.
Do you know if United and Delta are flying wide bodies?
I think United is 737s and Delta is A321s.
A321s. And one more question. What is the cost of a Super Bowl ticket these days?
The base price I think is like $400 to $500, but then the resale goes up. I remember a couple years ago, the average ticket price was something like $23,000.
$23,000?
Yeah. Let me just look right now. Hold on, let me just look. I'm going on StubHub.
Okay.
Here we go. It's the number one seller right now. Super Bowl 57, Philadelphia Eagles, Kansas City Chiefs, State Farm Stadium in Glendale, Arizona. I'm going to do two tickets. The cheapest for two right now is $4,859 each. So that would be just shy of $10,000 for two tickets. Let me see if I can find the most. Yeah, the most expensive right now that I'm seeing is $25,578 for one ticket.
That is crazy. So we're not going to Phoenix or the Super Bowl, but we are jet setting in opposite directions to Taipei and Tenerife. Of course, Doug, as Av Geeks, we've been doing the true Av Geek thing and have been looking at our flights to get an idea of what the routing will be. And I have to say, I've been kind of amazed that it isn't always the same. In fact, from day to day, it might vary by upwards of 1,000 miles or more. Why is this? And so you're going to be flying from San Francisco to Taipei over the Pacific. I imagine that as a straight line to Taipei. I'm going to be flying from Los Angeles to London on my first leg. If I can just picture it, I would think it goes over the Great Lakes and probably over northeastern Canada and maybe Greenland and then down to Europe. Is that about right?
Roughly, yeah. The Great Circle route would be something like that. And I know Aaron has pointed out that my Great Circle route estimations are not always great, so he'll probably correct us on that. But no, if you look up what's the flight number?
Flight number 136.
If the listeners look up American 136 from LA to London for the next week, you're going to see most likely a very different routing every single day. Same thing as you mentioned with the Taipei flight. There is a lot that goes into this, and the dispatchers are really good about how they plan the flights. It's basically the same for every airline, because airlines, they want three things. They want to make money on the flight. They don't want to lose money, and they want to make as much money as they can. They also want to get the passengers there as quickly as possible, as close to their arrival time or even a little bit early as possible. And then they want it to be a comfortable ride for the passengers. They don't want it to be maybe the fastest way there is through a whole bunch of moderate turbulence for 12 hours. That's not good for anyone, even though that's the fastest. That's not good for anyone. So there are functions, like there are algorithms and computer systems out there that the airline is able to weigh how much of each they want, how quickly they want the passengers to get there, how much money they want to make on that particular flight. And then the dispatcher looks at the rides, they look at the predicted weather, the predicted turbulence, and then their flight planning software is actually able to generate this flight plan based on all of these things. And it's three-dimensional as well. It's not just north, south, east, west on a map. There's also the altitudes. They might plan you for a lower altitude, which is less efficient, if that's where the better rides are going to be, if that's where you're going to avoid turbulence and lots of things like that. Now, going east to west, we always say winter winds in the northern hemisphere, that's when the winds are a lot higher. They may try and plan you into the jet stream, into that river of air to get a much faster ground speed across the ground. And the jet stream moves consistently. So that's why it may not be that straight line that you talked about. It might be 1,000 miles longer than what the Great Circle route is, but that's going to get you there faster because you can use that jet stream
Riding the wave, if you will.
You're riding the wave, exactly. Yeah. And then on the reverse of that, me going to Taipei, they don't want us in the jet stream. We're still going to have some headwinds, but the jet stream at this time of year could be upwards of 150 or 200 knots of wind in the face. That's going to slow you down substantially across the ground. That's like 200 miles per hour less across the ground if you're flying directly into the jet stream. And as we said, the jet stream moves day in, day out. It's a living, breathing thing in the atmosphere. And the dispatchers and the planning software try and avoid that westbound or try and utilize that eastbound.
Now, in the KC-10, you had to do your route planning. Am I right?
Sometimes. We did have dispatchers, but sometimes they were overworked and we had to do it. So then we had to go research that and figure out how we were going to get there.
So at the airlines, the dispatchers plan the routing. How often do you have to get involved, or do you see that the way they plan it is usually right on and there's no discrepancies or
discrepancies? We do not get, at the airline, we do not get involved at all. We leave it up to them because they know exactly what they're doing and we trust them. And the nice thing too is, especially at our airline, we have, and on your flight from LA to London, we're going to have a lot of flights that day in that region. So even if we don't have, we only have one daily flight to Taipei, but we have daily flights to lots of places in Asia, some of which might be leaving before us. And a lot of times that's the guinea pig airplane. And when we talk to dispatch before we go, if we're on the first Asian flight of the morning, they'll say, you guys are the guinea pig. You've got 10 Asian flights coming behind you. Yeah. So if you would, please just get ACARS, send me a message in ACARS, let me know how the rides are, let me know how it's going, and then I can communicate that to the other airplanes and they can know. So we're always communicating, but it's pretty amazing how the airlines, they maximize, like I said, the on-time performance with the revenue generation of the flight and the rides. And it's just this constant working relationship between all three of those things.
Now, when you're in flight, you know, you hear them making course changes, which they didn't plan for. How does that happen? Or why does that happen?
A lot of that could be air traffic control related, that the route that was filed might be too saturated. And so air traffic control will give a change of a route. Okay. Or it could be that their weather had moved into the area that was not expected. And so they're rerouting people around that weather. But that's where even when weather pops up, it's forecast, and dispatchers are really good about planning airplanes away from and around that weather to begin with. Doesn't mean that it may not pop up like summer thunderstorms over the Rockies. You can't predict that. You know they're going to pop up. Is it going to be in your route of flight? It's kind of like a crapshoot. We don't really know. So there are times where we do have to get reroutes, but it's few and far between. I would say usually we end up flying on what was filed.
Okay. So now sometimes at my work, we'll have a bunch of flights that are on the ground because there's a line of thunderstorms approaching, right? And they have to weave through them to leave the Washington area and then go across the ocean to Europe. So sometimes what they'll have, it's a standstill, and they will ask the crews, does anyone want to be a pathfinder? And a crew will volunteered to be the Pathfinder, and we love them because it's like, yeah, they're going to do it. So I remember we had our flight to London was the Pathfinder. So they took off, and a few minutes later, all the rest of the planes followed in the same path. So does that mean that they found a route through the thunderstorms that was smooth?
Yeah, smooth and kept them away from the thunderstorms because we like to avoid thunderstorms if we can avoid them, if at all possible. And they probably looked at the weather radar in the airplane. ATC in the U.S. has weather radar on their screens as well. And so they worked together, the crews worked together with air traffic control to find that route. Now, just as quickly as that airplane got through, that route could close up as the storms come together. So it's not a guaranteed thing that it's going to work. But if it does work and you can get several airplanes through, then yeah, go for it. And dispatch a lot of times will give us additional fuel as well if they are expecting deviations. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty common thing during the summer, as I mentioned, the Rockies. Middle of the afternoon, that sun is just beating down on the mountains, and then the warm air rises and it turns into thunderstorms, unpredictable thunderstorms. So a lot of times, most flights that go east to west over the Rockies during the summer, we'll have an extra few thousand pounds of gas, of fuel for planned deviations around storms. It's additional. It's not in the fuel plan initially, but it's extra in case we have to deviate from our flight plan and go a little bit out of the way.
Okay. And then as far as the Pathfinder, like, are those pilots that are like renegades that don't care and they're like more adventurous, or how does that, or
is that I don't know. I've never been one. I've never been offered to be one. And it makes it sound dangerous. Passengers, don't worry. It is not, it's not a dangerous thing. You have this, like you said, Drew, you have this line of storms, and then there is an opening.
There is
an opening. And it's like, okay, well, let's send someone through. Again, it's not going to be a dangerous thing, but the rides might be a little bumpier.
Yeah. Well, you said the airplane has a weather radar, air traffic control has a weather radar, so it's not like they're flying into the blind, right? There might be some turbulence.
Not at all.
They'll report back. No, pretty cool. So we're going in opposite directions. So I think that we should have rapid-fire pictures from Taiwan and Tenerife so that our listeners are completely confused as to where we are. The other thing, so you're actually going to Taipei this time. So you'll be in the city. So is your hotel in the city? Because I think
before... It's city center. It's right in the city center. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I want to hear all about it.
Well, Drew, Ian, and Charlie have an awesome trip. I can't wait to hear about it. Be sure to send me pictures along the way. I'll check them out while I'm out and about enjoying the night markets in Taipei and probably hiking and whatever other stuff I'll do for my layover. To our listeners, this podcast is your show, so go on our website, nexttripnetwork.com, and let us know what's on your mind so we can talk about it or give us your feedback. You can also follow us on Twitter or Instagram at Next Trip Podcast. Please tell your friends about us so we can reach more people who love aviation and travel.
Okay, so with this episode, we're putting a lid on the bad Tenerife discussions. When we say Tenerife, we're going to think beautiful beaches, beautiful scenery, sunny weather. So when you hear Tenerife, that's what you're going to think from now on. Thanks to all of our listeners for your support and for joining the conversation. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, stay aviation tough.
This has been the Next Trip Podcast. Visit nexttripnetwork.com for information about previous episodes, trip reviews, aviation photos, and other aviation-related content. This is your show, so search for The Next Trip on Twitter and let Doug and Drew know what you want to talk about. Not on Twitter? You can also email them at nexttrip.podcast@gmail.com. Please consider leaving a review wherever you download your podcasts. It will help other listeners like you discover this show.